We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week is Michael Chang. I had wanted to talk with Michael for a variety of reasons. One of them is the transition to clay as we now get to the part of the season for which he is best known, of course, the 1989 French Open. I wanted to talk about Zoom coaching. Michael's off Zoom. He's now back to coaching Kei Nishikori in person, but for months it was all done virtually. And then I wanted to talk about this horrible surge and scourge of anti-Asian violence that we're seeing in the United States and how Michael is experiencing this. So let's just get right to it. This is by turns a serious, poignant conversation and then some lighter tennis fare about underhand serves and tennis stories. But Michael had a lot to say, and I think this is it's a good listen. It's really a horrible, I resist even calling it a trend, but this is really a unpleasant, horrible surge we are seeing in violence against the Asian community in the United States, especially older members. And Michael has a lot of thoughts here. So let's go over to him right away. All right, here's Michael.
How are you doing? How are you? Where are you?
I'm actually in Bradenton.
Oh,
I'm a clay training block with Kay. It's been good. So yeah, getting ready for the clay court swing and trying to get him ready.
I was going to ask you how sounds like it's an obsolete question. I was going to ask how you were as a Zoom coach, but you're getting some in-person time, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been good to still do some training blocks. We actually had a training block prior to the Australian, which was kind of obviously tough since Kate got on that one plane that had positive COVID, you know, results, and then he was in the hotel for 2 weeks. So that was obviously tough. But yeah, I mean, I was in touch with him and talking about matches and, you know, trying to prepare him as best as I can from home. Max is obviously out there with him, you know, on a day in, day out basis, and he's got his trainers and stuff. It's actually tough to actually go to some of these events now because of the protocol. Mm-hmm. You know, the quarantine, obviously, you know, even credential wise, you know, we can't normally get, you know, everybody in there to be at events like we normally, you know, normally would. So that obviously makes the whole situation a lot more difficult.
I love the Michael Chang Max Murney combo. That is not the that's not the most obvious of pairings, but you guys seem to have made that work.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. You know, I think the nice thing is that both Max and I we have a very we have a pretty strong work ethic. Max loves to work hard. You know, I'm out there, you know, pushing Kay as much as I can. So it's been great him and talk about things strategically, very specific on how we're, you know, trying to train him, how we're trying to get him ready for either particular surfaces or particular you know, conditions or particular matches. So we get pretty detailed, and yeah, it's been good to have Max on board.
Great. And you're getting on planes again. So that's things are a little dicey in Europe. I don't know if you're going to go back to the scene of your towering achievement. I don't know who's going to the French Open right now, but it looks like you're traveling, so that's good.
Yeah, I actually did not travel literally for a year, which for, you know, and I'm normally with Kay on a regular year. I'm normally with him like 25 weeks out of the year. Obviously, a few of those weeks are obviously at home where he comes to California to train. But yeah, I mean, 25 weeks, and then I literally did not get on a plane for like a year. If you can believe that, I think a lot of other people are in that same boat. So
yeah, it's an adjustment. Happy we were able to connect. I'm always happy we were able to connect, but I thought sort of these days in particular, because I wanted to sort of get a sense of how you've been experiencing this horrible wave of anti-Asian attacks that we're fortunately enduring. How have you been, and how have you been dealing with this?
I think it's been really disturbing. I think, I mean, obviously that's, you know, these attacks have occurred, all around the U.S. A lot of different age groups, but, you know, particularly disturbing are the ones that that are happening to the elderly Asians, Asian Americans, guys and men and women that are in their 70s, their 80s. I mean, even in the Bay Area, the guy was not 91 years old. That to me is incredibly disturbing. And these are people that, you know, pose no threat to society. Really their aim in life is really just to, you know, to love their kids and their grandkids. And, you know, they've worked hard all their lives to try to give their families a better life. And in the meantime, they're, you know, in these situations that are not just verbal, but it's physical. And it's incredibly, incredibly disturbing. I was telling Tom a little bit earlier, he asked me, he said, what have you actually experienced any of this? And I was actually telling him, I was like, strangely, actually I haven't had any physical attacks, but, Amber and I, quite a few months back, we were in a local Walmart, just, you know, picking up some stuff, and an elderly Caucasian gentleman walked by us and was like basically said, "Hey, you guys need to go back to China. You guys that brought the coronavirus." And it was amazing. I've never, you know, I looked at Amber, she looked at me, and we were like, "Did he just say what I thought he said?" You know. And Amber walked up to him, and he's like, "Excuse me, what did you just say?" And he goes, "You guys go back to China," you know? And it was really it's kind of laughable a little bit. But it was just, it was incredibly, bothersome to hear, somebody say that. And obviously, you know, obviously not everybody feels this way. You're not having people rallying and saying, "Hey, you know, we're rallying against Asian Americans here in the United States." Obviously there's been a lot of support, which has been great, from all ethnicities, in regards to these attacks, and people showing that, "Hey, you know, we care about the Asian American society. They're important to us. Not all of us feel this way." But obviously there are those few that are, you know, in my mind, you know, ignorant of what the real situation is, but they're trying to find blame for this whole pandemic, of which obviously Asian Americans and all Americans really, you know, are not to blame, obviously. So,
how do you respond? I mean, you know, it's not incumbent on you to tell some bigot, "Hey, I was born here," or there, it doesn't even make sense. Like, why would I go back to the place where, it's illogical, it's offensive, but what's your response? How do you react in that moment?
I think, you know, I think the Asian way to respond, normally is just to blow it off. Right. obviously there have been some instances where it's been confrontational, and I've seen some other videos where Asians are, you know, they have to stand up and they have to kind of get in the person's face because their children are there. Their children are next to them. So, you know, thankfully our children were not in that, you know, were not with us at that particular time. You hear people sometimes say certain things and different things, whether it's, you know, even if it's not racist. And sometimes you just, for me, I just kind of blow it off and I'm just like, you know what? You don't really know what you're talking about. You're kind of ignorant of the situation and I just kind of like, you know, just kind of blow it off as if like they just don't understand. So.
You mentioned, I'm sort of curious on both generational levels. How are the older members of your family dealing with this, and how are you and Amber explaining this to your kids?
To be honest, I haven't actually taken the time to explain it to our kids. I think they're a little bit young. My youngest is 5. I have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. My 10-year-old obviously probably understands a lot more what's going on. I've had this discussion now with my mom. She's pretty cautious about going out for a couple of reasons. You know, one reason was because of the pandemic, obviously, because she's older. You know, my mom's 77 years old. My dad will turn 79. They're in that age where obviously it's a danger age, but now you worry about like, you know, going out by yourself. It's a crazy world that we live in, that they actually have to be concerned about that. And it's weird to actually have the conversation with my mom and say, you know, hey, you know, when you go out and stuff like that, you whatever you need to go get groceries or whatever, either you let me go get it or you have somebody go with you. It's not an option for you to just, you know, go by yourself anymore. You can't take that risk, especially at that age where if something happens, a fall, I mean, we've seen it already. It can do, it can take a person's life, which obviously it has.
If we proceed on the assumption that hate is learned, what's going on here? I mean, what do you attribute this to? I mean, I'll be blunt, and I don't want to guide you here if you're not comfortable. We have a former president who calls this China virus and Kung flu, and that's sort of hard for me not to make a nexus there. But what's going on here? I mean, how do you sort of interpret this?
Well, I mean, obviously that doesn't help the situation. I think what is happening in some instances, people get to a point. I don't think any of us have really been in this kind of a pandemic ever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just taken its toll for a lot of people. Obviously, it's been, for some people, it's a little bit easier to deal with than other people. Under the circumstances, obviously, people know that, the coronavirus, you know, originated in Wuhan. So they draw the correlation there between China and Asians, and saying, you know, hey, you're to blame for it, but how are Asian Americans to blame for that? I think that there are sometimes people are at the end of their rope. I think in certain aspects they're you know, kind of going stir crazy to some degree. Some people just, you know, being inside, not being able to go out, not have the freedom to be able to do things that they want to do, having to wear masks all the time. Obviously, a lot of people that don't want to wear masks. Some people don't want to get the vaccine. So it's a different life than normal what people are living in. And unfortunately, under the circumstances, I think people want somebody to blame. And I think that the Asian American community is the easiest to blame for some individuals. Obviously, not everybody feels that way, thankfully. But for some people that have come to the end of their rope, that's where they want to blame, and that's where they take their anger out. But as we know in life and in history, you know, anger, hate, you know, never helped help solve a problem. And certainly this, you know, just intensifies, you know, kind of dealing with the whole melting pot of the United States and really trying to, you know, accept one another and get along.
I wanted to ask you about that because stick with me here. I was trying to look up your brother's age. I was trying to look up Carl's age. And I came, this was the very first Google hit I found. It was about your, it was about you, but it was, you know, his, he was in the story. And the first paragraph of the article, a generation ago, Joe Chang set off from China like a wave crossing to the other end of the world. In America, he met his wife, Betty, who's also Chinese. He graduated from night school. They raised their two sons in a house with a stately Chinese living room and a casual American family room with a big TV at one end. And it's a great paragraph. Ian Thompson, a former colleague of mine, should come in for some credit there. But it really struck me how, you know, how often your story was framed as this great sort of immigrant success story. And I'm wondering sort of what this last year has done to your relationship, your feelings about the United States, just in part because your status as this sort of great immigrant success story was so fundamental to anyone talking about Michael Chang.
Right. You know, it's interesting because when I grew up and I would have conversations with my mom and dad about how they chose to raise us, I never got an answer saying, yeah, you know, you're born, you're at the Chinese, we're going to raise you as Chinese, we're going to live very Chinese culture. I've never had that aspect, but I've never had the other aspect where, you know, we're in America, you're born American, we're going to raise you as, you know, purely American, you're only going to speak English, you know, this type. It was always a combination of the two. And it was interesting because whenever you'd have a conversation with my mom and dad, they would always say, we're going to take the best sides of both. And I think that was really, you know, hit the nail on the head because, you know, that's the way you can really be successful. Obviously, you don't want to lose your heritage, but at the same time, you want to embrace what, you know, the opportunities that that America gives you. And, you know, that's part of the reason why, you know, my family chose to come over to start a better life over here. So, you know, as far as has this whole situation changed my view of America, it hasn't. I still view, you know, obviously I'm American, obviously I'm Asian American, but my view of the United States is always going to be in a very positive light because I focus on the positive. Does it have negatives? Sure. But I'm not going to allow, you know, a negative here or a negative there to make such an impression upon my mentality that I believe that every part of America is negative because it's not. And I think that's the danger, I think, sometimes, right, is if you just focus on the negative, if you just focus on the incident here or the incidents in New York or you know, San Francisco or Atlanta, it's easy to have that perspective. But there are positive sides as well. So and you need to be able to see both.
Right. No, that's really well said. Keep going with the positive. What did you take that to mean when your parents said, we want to take the best of both cultures? What specifically did you take that to mean?
Well, I think, for instance, you know, the opportunities to go into, to play in all these different places, the opportunities to work hard. You know, I think that Asian mentality very much is, if you work hard, if you put in the effort and the dedication, you will be rewarded. You will be rewarded. And that's really kind of up to you. If you want to take a mentality where, you know, you want to lounge around and just watch TV and not really want to make anything out of yourself, then you can do that too. You have the freedom to do as you choose to do. But you know, my family, my parents always told me, he said, look, whatever you want to do, you go and you try to be the best at it. And you have a passion for it and you have a drive for it. And obviously for me, it was, you know, it was tennis. And, you know, they taught me to go into, you know, put my whole heart into it, no matter where I was, no matter who I was playing, no matter if the crowd was for me or against me, which obviously in tennis, you have that in differing situations. But America gives you that, that opportunity and that freedom to be able to do that. And I'm thankful for that.
Did you ever feel, this was obviously some time ago when it was pre-corona, but did you ever feel anti-Asian bias on the tennis tour?
You know, it's interesting. I actually did not feel any racism necessarily on the ATP tour. I did feel racism, or not really racism, but I did feel people looked at me negatively sometimes because of my age when I first came on tour. And then also because of my Christian faith. So I would say those two things. You know, when I first came on tour, it was a little bit, there were a couple guys that were like, you know, you really shouldn't be here. You're 15, 16 years old. You know, we don't really want you out here. I remember one of my first tournaments that I played. You're going to laugh at this. So I was working with Brian Gottfried. He happened to be traveling with me at the time. And I had played a couple of exhibition tournaments before I was to make my professional debut in Memphis. And I was warming up, you know, practicing with this one guy. At the time, I had no volleys. My volleys were non-existent. So I actually came into the net, and I started taking volleys, and I literally would miss every other volley. And this would go on for like a couple minutes, three minutes, 4 minutes. Finally, the guy that I was hitting with walks over to the side. I'm not going to tell you who it is. The guy walked over to the side, gave Brian Gottfried the balls, and I'm standing right there at the net. I can hear everything he's saying. And he goes, Brian, he goes, why don't you warm up Michael's volleys? I'm going to get a drink. And when you're done, I'll come back and we'll finish the rest of our practice. But I have to say that the tour, I think, is very unique. And I personally have not felt any racism as far as being Asian or Asian American. And I think the part of the reason is because there are so many players from so many different parts of the world, and we play all over the world. The tour is a huge melting pot. If you're different, you're normal. You know what I mean? Right. So every day, you know, people, players, coaches, you know, we know you're from, you speak Spanish, or you speak, you know, whatever, French, or you're from Australia, or you're from South America, or whatever. And we just look at each other as tennis players. We don't look at the other aspects of it.
As long as you went, you kind of came close. It's one of my all-time favorite stories too. When you, we can edit this out if you don't want to go there, but when you saw Lendl after the 1989 French Open, when you saw him the next time, you want to tell that story? It sort of goes to the same theme.
Yeah.
This guy, you underhand serve and you see him, and tell us what happens when you ran into him the very next time.
You know, it was interesting because I knew Yvonne. I didn't know him really, really well at that point. I got a chance to know him a lot better after. But I didn't see him post French Open match in the locker room or anything. So the next time I actually saw Yvonne was at Arangi, the week before Wimbledon started. And I remember, you know, there's that one walkway that you go to the right, and I was already in that walkway, and he was coming back, cause he had finished practice, and I couldn't really like turn around to go up the stairs the other way. And I'm like, oh, here he comes, you know? And I really wasn't sure, like, you know, how he would react. I wasn't sure if he would just like ignore me or anything. And I kind of, you know, would look up, kind of look down, look up, look down. And I'm like, oh shoot, he's like beelining for me. And I was like, oh man, you know, what's he going to say? And the amazing thing is that he walked straight up to me, basically got straight in front of me. And he was like, Michael, put his hand out. He goes, unbelievable job at the French Open. Congratulations. I was like, wow, thanks. You appreciate that. Yeah, I would not have expected that.
Love that story.
I would not have expected that. And it's strange. I've always had a very good relationship with Yvonne. And I've probably have beaten him on a couple of really, really big occasions. And they both were similar. So one was at the French Open, obviously in 89, I was down two sets to love. And then the other time I was playing him was in the Grand Slam Cup, which you remember the prize money was huge in that tournament. I was down two sets to love and I saved a match point and I beat him 9-7 in the fifth. It's the only two times I played him in a Grand Slam tournament. And you would think that he would be like, you know, oh, you know, I don't really like this kid or whatever. I've always gotten along with him. I have nothing but the utmost respect for him. Periodically I'll still, text him and give him a hard time about something. And then obviously I'd see him periodically on tour when he was out coaching Andy or Zverev, I'd run into him every now and then. And whenever we run into each other, we always chat for a few minutes, but we never talk about the French.
No, I love the story that you're confronting this, I think he's the number one player in the world. And, he was very gracious. Yeah. I bet you did not think, I'm trying to do the math in my head, carry the two. It was 32 years ago, I think. Did you ever think the underhand serve would still be this this hot button topic?
No, I would not. But then again, nobody stands as far back as they do to return serve, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You had Bjorn was back there for a little bit. You know, you had some other guys, but nothing like nothing like Rafa and Dominic. I mean, they're way back there. I don't know what they would do if you put them on a clay court that actually wasn't that big. What would they do? You know, they probably ask the well, there's no linesman anymore. Thankfully, that probably gives them another few feet to work.
What's right. A linesman? I can't really remember that concept. I think you're right. I mean, we were joking. We said there are matches sometimes where you literally cannot see the receiver based on the camera angle.
Yeah.
Well, what are you supposed to do if someone? Yeah. Back that far.
I've heard some guys actually asked for the linesman to move, or you know, they have those like boxes, right, that they use for advertisement that the chair goes on in the back for them to move that, because they need more space. But I mean, the other flip topic part of that is that, you know, guys are serving bigger, right? They're able to generate more spin and more pace now because of the strength rackets, which obviously, you know, if you're going to hit at waist level, you got to go even further back than you did, you know, 15 years ago. Cause you know, guys couldn't generate that.
Right. I was thinking about whether to put you on the spot and ask if, as a Californian, if you thought we should have a full prize money Indian Wells instead of keeping commitments to the Asia swing, but I'll spare you I'll spare you that one, unless of course you want to go there. Go ahead.
For tournaments, there's no question about it. You know, it was interesting because I think people were chuckling when they first found out that I played the first, you know, Shanghai Open back in the day. When there weren't any, you know, Chinese tournaments at all. Now, obviously, you've got some of the biggest Chinese tournaments now in the world, and you've had the ATP Finals there in Shanghai. And then on top of that, obviously, I love Indian Wells. It's always been a special place for me. I've won three times there, and it's really, you know, kind of in my backyard. You know, under the circumstances, I almost kind of wish that. You know, everybody's trying to accommodate everybody, especially in this pandemic, until we get to a regular calendar again. But I can understand, concerns on both sides, especially when they're, you know, when they're so far apart in distance. Yeah.
Well played. No, I mean, I think it's, these are strange times. I'm happy you're back out there. Happy you're getting on planes. It's distressing and disheartening what we're going through in this country right now. I mean, let me sort of close here. I mean, I hope this doesn't sound overly hokey, but if we're talking in terms of allies and anti-racism. I mean, what can people do that are as offended by this as anyone else? I mean, I think it sounds like you recognize that the vast majority of Americans find this repugnant and abhorrent, but I mean, what would you like to see people do to take a stand against this?
I mean, I think part of it is certainly awareness. It does nobody any good if you know, all these instances are just swept under the rug. I think when people see that there is injustice, you see more and more people, you know, talk about it. You see more and more people discuss it. You see more and more people, you know, trying to find ways and solutions to deal with this. Part of it is I think helping these individuals that have this mindset to understand that, like, their mentality is wrong, that they're not understanding the whole situation, you know, properly. You know, Asian Americans are just like any other Americans, and trying to go out there and you know, trying to live a life that's the American life, trying to be successful. You know, trying to go out and to you know, help one another. I mean, that's really the mentality that people should have. Because violence and hate, you know, never made society better. It's always the other way around. It's always, you know, taking the time to understand one another, taking the time to help one another, taking the time to touch a person's life, no matter who they are, no matter what race they come from. You know, so, yeah, I mean, I hope that, people will understand that, and somehow or another, for those individuals that feel that Asian Americans are to blame in some way, shape, or form for this pandemic, I hope that they will change their attitude, and realize that the way they're thinking is wrong and it needs to change. America is not a better America, you know, for people to have this kind of attitude and this kind of hate. It's just no place for it. It doesn't make our country better.
Exactly. Well put, well said. I'm so sorry we're all going through this. I'm sorry the Asian American community is going through this. It's really this disgraceful surge, but you like to think good wins out. You're off to are you headed to Europe, or is this this training?
I'm gonna home on Friday. I have to. I'm gonna go caddy for my daughter. on the week.
Good. She's a talented golfer. I'll leave it at that.
So they're at that age. Amber and I are having so much fun. I don't know if Tom told you, but we made a trip to Hawaii. Actually, Hawaii was I think our first trip that we took on an airplane. So at that particular time, coronavirus was pretty bad in Southern California. So we were like, you know what, let's just get away. So we had the mask on, we had like the face shield, everything, and we got on the plane. And then it was funny because there was like 15 people on our flight. It was so empty and nobody was going to Hawaii. So we ended up staying there for a week. And the end of the week, Amber's like, so why are we going back?
Exactly.
You know, numbers are bad in California. Right. Here, we were in Kona, so we were not that far from Hualalai. We were out in Mauna Lani. And the numbers there on the island every day was single digits, either 1 to 9, some anywhere between there per day. The coronavirus was very, very low. You had to take a test, and you had to be negative before you got on the plane. And then when you got off the plane, they took another test. Otherwise, you had to go to some special hotel. So whenever you went back to the hotel, they checked your temperature. So we ended up staying there for 5.5 weeks.
I bet your kids were miserable. No, good for you. You're right. I mean, you could be anywhere. Why not?
Yeah, they could do school online, you know, they it was great. There was tennis, there was golf. I mean, the whales were there at the time, you know, turtles, fish, you know, I mean, it was incredible. So, yeah, after the 5 weeks, Amber was like, why are we going back again? I'm like, I need to go back at some point.
But you played that card once. That's silver lining though. That's great. All right. Thanks for visiting. Always a pleasure. And hope we see each other sooner rather than later. But okay. Thanks again.
All righty, take it easy.
All right, take care. Thanks, Michael.
Okay, thanks to our guest Michael Chang. Got a little heavy there as it should have. And I think sometimes we underestimate just how important a figure Michael was and is in the Asian American community. I heard someone now in their late 30s say, look, growing up, the two figures that my household idolized were Connie Chung and Michael Chang. And I know he had a huge impact on millions of people here in the United States and, of course, in Asia as well. So thanks to Michael for the time and the candor. Thanks, as always, to Jamie. We will see what's going on with the French Open. As we record this, it's looking increasingly likely like it will be pushed back a week. That's being done, of course, to accommodate as many fans and as much hospitality as possible. The impact of that on the grass court season, that will now create a gap in the schedule. All of it is tennis in the time of Corona, but we'll see how this all plays out. We will have a new guest next week, perhaps from Monte Carlo, logistics willing. Thanks, everyone, for listening, for the guest suggestions. Keep them coming, as always. Subscribe, leave a review, spread the word. iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll do it again in 7 days. Have a good week, everyone.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.